Almost 70,000 people were killed or wounded by Serb forces shooting into the city, roughly 20% of the population. The United Nations estimated that half of the children in the city had seen someone killed in front of them, and about 1 in 5 had lost a family member in the war. People intentionally exposed themselves to snipers just to be put out of their misery. 1 year into the siege, just before I got to the city, a teenage couple walked into no man's land along the Miljačka River, trying to cross into a Serb-held area. They were quickly gunned down, the young man falling first, and the woman crawling over to him as she died. He was a Serb and she was a Muslim, and they had been in love all through high school. They lay there for days because the area was too dangerous for anyone to retrieve their bodies. I saw a lot of strange things in that city, the kinds of contortions that only war can bring to a people. But maybe the most startling was this. A middle-aged man in a business suit crouched over some small project in the courtyard of a modern high-rise. The building could have been any bank or insurance company in Europe, except that the windows were blown out and the walls were scarred with shrapnel. I looked closer and saw that the man was arranging dead twigs into a pile. When he was done, he positioned an aluminum pot on top of the pile and lit the twigs with a cigarette lighter. Then he stood up and looked at me. If there's an image of the apocalypse, I thought, it might be a man in a business suit building a fire in the courtyard of an abandoned high-rise. In different circumstances, it could be any of us, anywhere. But it had happened to him here, and there wasn't much I could do about it. I nodded to him, and he nodded back, and then I left him in peace. The one thing that might be said for societal collapse is that, for a while at least, everyone is equal. In 1915, an earthquake killed 30,000 people in Avezzano, Italy, in less than a minute. The worst-hit areas had a mortality rate of 96%. The rich were killed along with the poor, and virtually everyone who survived was immediately thrust into the most basic struggle for survival. They needed food, they needed water, they needed shelter, and they needed to rescue the living and bury the dead. In that sense, plate tectonics under the town of Avezzano managed to recreate the communal conditions of our evolutionary past quite well. An earthquake achieves what the law promises but does not in practice maintain, one of the survivors wrote, the equality of all men. As Thomas Paine labored to articulate his goals for a free society, he could have easily taken his inspiration from earthquake survivors instead of from the American Indians. Communities that have been devastated by natural or man-made disasters almost never lapse into chaos and disorder. If anything, they become more just, more egalitarian, and more deliberately fair to individuals. Despite erroneous news reports, New Orleans experienced a drop in crime rates after Hurricane Katrina, and much of the looting turned out to be people looking for food. The kinds of community-oriented behaviors that typically occur after a natural disaster are exactly the virtues that Paine was hoping to promote in his revolutionary tracts. The question of societal breakdown in the face of calamity suddenly became urgent in the run-up to World War II, when the world powers were anticipating aerial bombardments deliberately calculated to cause mass hysteria in the cities. English authorities, for example, predicted that German attacks would produce 35,000 casualties a day in London alone. Total civilian casualties for the country were not even twice that. No one knew how a civilian population would react to that kind of trauma. But the Churchill government assumed the worst. So poor was their opinion of the populace, particularly the working-class people of East London, that emergency planners were reluctant to even build public bomb shelters because they worried people would move into them and simply never move out. Economic production would plummet, and the shelters themselves, it was feared, would become a breeding ground for political dissent and even communism. Nothing could have been further from the truth. We would really have all gone down to the beaches with broken bottles, one woman remembered of the public's determination to fight the Germans. We would have done anything, anything, to stop them. On September 7th, 1940, German bombers started hitting London in earnest and did not let up until the following May. For 57 consecutive days, waves of German bombers flew over London and dropped thousands of tons of high explosives directly into residential areas, killing hundreds of people at a time. Throughout the Blitz, as it was known, many Londoners trudged to work in the morning, trudged across town to shelters or tube stations in the evening, and then trudged back to work again when it got light. Conduct was so good in the shelters that volunteers never even had to summon the police to maintain order. If anything, the crowd policed themselves according to unwritten rules that made life bearable for complete strangers jammed shoulder to shoulder on floors that were at times awash in urine. 10,000 people had come together without ties of friendship or economics, with no plans at all as to what they meant to do, one man wrote about life in a massive concrete structure known as Tilbury Shelter. They found themselves literally overnight inhabitants of a vague twilight town of strangers. At first, there were no rules, rewards, or penalties, no hierarchy or command. Almost immediately, laws began to emerge, laws enforced not by police and wardens, who at first proved helpless in the face of such multitudes, but by the shelterers themselves. 8 million men, women, and children in Greater London endured the kind of aerial bombardment that even soldiers are rarely subjected to. Often the badly wounded were just given morphine and left to die in the rubble, while rescue crews moved on to people they thought they could save. The tempo of the bombing was so intense, one woman recalled, that it sounded like an enormous marching band stomping around the city. Another recounted being flattened by an explosion and finding herself clutching the floor as if it were a cliff face that I had to hang on to. A food manufacturing plant named Hartley's was bombed, and the dead were carried out covered in marmalade. A hat factory was hit, and the dead were brought out bristling with sewing needles. One underground shelter took a direct hit, and 600 people were killed instantly. Another was hit by a bomb that severed a water main, and more than 100 people died when their shelter flooded in minutes. On and on the horror went, people dying in their homes or neighborhoods while doing the most mundane things. Not only did these experiences fail to produce mass hysteria, they didn't even trigger much individual psychosis. Before the war, projections for psychiatric breakdown in England ran as high as 4 million people. But as the Blitz progressed, psychiatric hospitals around the country saw admissions go down. Emergency services in London reported an average of only 2 cases of bomb neurosis a week. Psychiatrists watched in puzzlement as long-standing patients saw their symptoms subside during the period of intense air raids. Voluntary admissions to psychiatric wards noticeably declined, and even epileptics reported having fewer seizures. Chronic neurotics of peacetime now drive ambulances, one doctor remarked. Another ventured to suggest that some people actually did better during wartime. The positive effects of war on mental health were first noticed by the great sociologist Emile Durkheim, who found that when European countries went to war, suicide rates dropped. Psychiatric wards in Paris were strangely empty during both world wars, and that remained true even as the German army rolled into the city in 1940. Researchers documented a similar phenomenon during civil wars in Spain, Algeria, Lebanon, and Northern Ireland. An Irish psychologist named H.A. Lyons found that suicide rates in Belfast dropped 50% during the riots of 1969 and 1970, and homicide and other violent crimes also went down. Depression rates for both men and women declined abruptly during that period, with men experiencing the most extreme drop in the most violent districts. County Derry, on the other hand, which suffered almost no violence at all, saw male depression rates rise rather than fall. Lyons hypothesized that men in the peaceful areas were depressed because they couldn't help their society by participating in the struggle. When people are actively engaged in a cause, their lives have more purpose, with a resulting improvement in mental health, Lyons wrote in the Journal of Psychosomatic Research in 1979. It would be irresponsible to suggest violence as a means of improving mental health, But the Belfast findings suggest that people will feel better psychologically if they have more involvement with their community. During the London Blitz, the sheer regularity of the air raids seemed to provide its own weird reassurance, and the intense racket of the anti-aircraft batteries, however ineffective, helped keep Londoners from feeling completely helpless. The total amount of beer consumed in the city did not change much, and neither did the rate of church attendance. People did resort to superstition and magic, however, carrying talismans or sprigs of heather and refusing, for some reason, to wear green. One woman felt that the Germans were targeting her specifically and would go out only if she could blend into a crowd. Another man found his service pistol from the First World War and tried to teach his wife how to kill Germans with it. Men reported smoking more. Women reported feeling depressed more, though statistically they attempted suicide less. In March 1941, perhaps in an attempt to demystify the enemy, British authorities deposited a German Junkers 88 dive bomber in one of the most severely damaged neighborhoods of Plymouth. The plane sat there, unlabeled, unguarded, and unexplained, while citizens wandered up to examine it, and observers quietly took notes. The overwhelming effect was of mild pleasure, interest, and relief, one researcher noted of people's reactions. Men were more interested in the material, engine, craftsmanship, all of which were elaborately praised. Women noticed especially the size. Some evidently thought of an enemy bomber as a remote thing, a specter in the sky. The reality was somehow reassuring, almost friendly. The reactions of thousands of civilians to the stresses of war were recorded in detail by something known as mass observation, which was a mostly volunteer corps of Britons who were asked to observe their countrymen as if they were birds. Some volunteers went out every day and wrote down everything they saw or heard. Others were told to keep journals and to fill out questionnaires about their experiences and feelings. The project proved controversial because it documented what was already obvious. The air raids failed to trigger the kind of mass hysteria that government officials had predicted. That, ironically, was an unwelcome bit of news once the tide of war had turned and Allied forces adopted the same strategy of apocalyptic air raids against the Germans. The Blitz, as bad as it was, paled in comparison to what the Allies did. Dresden lost more people in one night than London did during the entire war. Firestorms engulfed whole neighborhoods and used up so much oxygen that people who were untouched by the blasts reportedly died of asphyxiation instead. Fully a third of the German population was subjected to bombardment, and around 1 million people were killed or wounded. American analysts based in England monitored the effects of the bombing to see if any cracks began to appear in the German resolve, and to their surprise found exactly the opposite. The more the Allies bombed, the more defiant the German population became. Industrial production actually rose in Germany during the war, and the cities with the highest morale were the ones, like Dresden, that were bombed the hardest. According to German psychologists who compared notes with their American counterparts after the war, it was the untouched cities where civilian morale suffered the most. 30 years later, H.A. Lyons would document an almost identical phenomenon in riot-torn Belfast. The United States Strategic Bombing Survey posted observers in England to evaluate the effectiveness of their strategy, and one of them, Charles Fritz, became an open critic of the rationale behind the bombing campaign. Intrigued by the fact that in both England and Germany, civilian resilience had risen in response to the air raids, Fritz went on to complete a more general study of how communities respond to calamity. After the war, he turned his attention to natural disasters in the United States and formulated a broad theory about social resilience. He was unable to find a single instance where communities that had been hit by catastrophic events lapsed into sustained panic, much less anything approaching anarchy. If anything, he found that social bonds were reinforced during disasters and that people overwhelmingly devoted their energies toward the good of the community rather than just themselves. In 1961, Fritz assembled his ideas into a lengthy paper that began with the startling sentence, "Why do large-scale disasters produce such mentally healthy conditions?" His data was compiled by a team of 25 researchers who worked for the National Opinion Research Center, NORC, based at the University of Chicago. Their job was to rush to disaster sites and interview the inhabitants about how they were adapting to their new circumstances. By 1959, NORC researchers had compiled roughly 9,000 survivor interviews. Fritz also scoured academic publications for anything related to natural or man-made disasters. His study was conducted during the height of the Cold War, when the Russian nuclear threat was foremost in the minds of civil defense planners. Never mentioned in the report, though impossible to ignore, is the possibility that the study was intended to assess whether the United States could continue to function after a nuclear exchange with Russia. Fritz's theory was that modern society has gravely disrupted the social bonds that have always characterized the human experience, and that disasters thrust people back into a more ancient, organic way of relating. Disasters, he proposed, create a community of sufferers that allows individuals to experience an immensely reassuring connection to others. As people come together to face an existential threat, Fritz found, class differences are temporarily erased, income disparities become irrelevant, race is overlooked, and individuals are assessed simply by what they are willing to do for the group. It is a kind of fleeting social utopia that, Fritz felt, is enormously gratifying to the average person and downright therapeutic to people suffering from mental illness. Fritz's conclusions were later borne out in a study of the city of Yungay in central Chile, which was struck by a devastating earthquake and rock slide on May 31, 1970. 90% of the population of Yungay died almost instantly, and 70,000 people were killed throughout the region, roughly equivalent to a nuclear strike on that area. The rock slide that buried the city put so much dust into the air that helicopters couldn't land, and the survivors of Yungay were left completely on their own for days. Into this terrifying vacuum, a new social order quickly sprang up. Concepts of individual private property temporarily submerged, anthropologist Anthony Oliver Smith later wrote in his paper, Brotherhood of Pain. The crisis also had an immediate status-leveling effect on the nascent community of survivors it had created. A sense of brotherhood prevailed as Indian and Mestizo, lower and upper class, collaborated in the collective efforts to obtain immediate necessities and survive. As soon as relief flights began delivering aid to the area, class divisions returned and the sense of brotherhood disappeared. The modern world had arrived. If there are phrases that characterize the life of our early ancestors, community of sufferers and brotherhood of pain surely must come close. Their lives were probably less labor-intensive than lives in modern society, as demonstrated by the Kung, but the mortality rate would have been much higher. The advantages of group cooperation would include far more effective hunting and defense, and groups that failed to function cooperatively must have gradually died out. Adaptive behavior tends to be reinforced hormonally, emotionally, and culturally, and one can see all three types of adaptation at work in people who act on behalf of others. Humans are so strongly wired to help one another and enjoy such enormous social benefits from doing so that people regularly risk their lives for complete strangers. That risk-taking tends to express itself in very different ways in men and in women. Men perform the vast majority of bystander rescues, and children, the elderly, and women are the most common recipients of them. Children are helped regardless of gender, as are the elderly, but women of reproductive age are twice as likely to be helped by a stranger than men are. Men have to wait, on average, until age 75 before they can expect the same kind of assistance in a life-threatening situation that women get their whole lives. Given the disproportionately high value of female reproduction to any society, risking male lives to save female lives makes enormous evolutionary sense. According to a study based on a century of records at the Carnegie Hero Fund Commission, male bystanders performed more than 90% of spontaneous rescues of strangers, and around 1 in 5 were killed in the attempt. Hero is generally defined as risking your life to save non-kin from mortal danger. The resulting mortality rate is higher than for most U.S. combat units. researchers theorize that greater upper body strength and a predominantly male personality trait known as impulsive sensation-seeking lead men to overwhelmingly dominate this form of extreme caretaking. But women are more likely than men to display something called moral courage. The Righteous Among the Nations is an award given to non-Jews who helped save Jewish lives during the Holocaust, and by its very nature selects for people who have a deep moral conviction about right and wrong. In Poland, the Netherlands, and France, providing refuge to Jews who were trying to evade the German authorities was a crime punishable by death. And while the decision to do so didn't require the same kind of muscular action that men excel at, it could be just as deadly. There are more than 20,000 names in the Righteous Among the Nations records, and an analysis conducted in 2004 found that if married couples are excluded, women slightly outnumber men in the list of people who risk their lives to help Jews. The greater empathic concern women demonstrate for others may lead them to take positions on moral or social issues that men are less likely to concern themselves with. Women tend to act heroically within their own moral universe, regardless of whether anyone else knows about it, donating more kidneys to non-relatives than men do, for example. Men, on the other hand, are far more likely to risk their lives at a moment's notice, and that reaction is particularly strong when others are watching, or when they are part of a group. In late 2015, a bus in eastern Kenya was stopped by gunmen from an extremist group named Al-Shabaab that made a practice of massacring Christians as part of a terrorism campaign against the Western-aligned Kenyan government. The gunmen demanded that Muslim and Christian passengers separate themselves into two groups so that the Christians could be killed. But the Muslims, most of whom were women, refused to do it. They told the gunmen that they would all die together if necessary, but that the Christians would not be singled out for execution. The Shabaab eventually let everyone go. Sexual division of risk-taking would seem to suit the human race particularly well. We evolved and continue to exist in a physical world that assaults us with threats, but we also depend on a strong sense of morality and social justice to keep our communities intact. And intact communities are far more likely to survive than fragmented ones. When a woman gives shelter to a family because she doesn't want to raise her children in a world where people can be massacred because of their race or their beliefs, she is taking a huge risk, but also promoting a kind of moral thinking that has clearly kept hominid communities glued together for hundreds of thousands of years. It is exactly the same kind of altruistic choice, with all the attendant risks and terrors, that a man makes when he runs into a burning building to save someone else's children. Both are profound acts of selflessness that distinguish us from all other mammals, including the higher primates that we are so closely related to. The beauty and the tragedy of the modern world is that it eliminates many situations that require people to demonstrate a commitment to the collective good. Protected by police and fire departments, and relieved of most of the challenges of survival, an urban man might go through his entire life without having to come to the aid of someone in danger, or even give up his dinner. Likewise, a woman in a society that has codified its moral behavior into a set of laws and penalties might never have to make a choice that puts her very life at risk. What would you risk dying for and for whom is perhaps the most profound question a person can ask themselves. The vast majority of people in modern society are able to pass their whole lives without ever having to answer that question, which is both an enormous blessing and a significant loss. It is a loss because having to face that question has, for tens of millennia, been one of the ways that we have defined ourselves as people. And it is a blessing because life has gotten far less difficult and traumatic than it was for most people even a century ago. The gender differentiation of courage during life and death situations is so vital to group survival that it seems to get duplicated even within same-sex groups. Like most dangerous jobs, coal mining is an almost exclusively male activity that generally draws its workers from a particularly undereducated, blue-collar population. Disasters happen with appalling regularity in the industry, and when they do, groups of men are often trapped miles underground for days or weeks at a time. These incidents have offered social scientists a way to examine how men react to danger and organize themselves to maximize their chances of survival. At 8:05 on the evening of October 23, 1958, the Spring Hill Mine in Nova Scotia experienced what coal miners know as a bump, a sudden contraction and settling of sedimentary layers deep underground that generates the forces of a massive explosion throughout the complex. Spring Hill was one of the deepest coal mines in the world, and the bump of 1958 was so powerful that it was felt 800 miles away. There were 174 men in the mine at the time, and 74 were killed immediately as strata compressed and passageways collapsed. Of the survivors, 81 men were able to make their way to safety, and 19 found themselves trapped more than 12,000 feet down the mine shafts. Several were badly injured, and two were pinned by debris and unable to move. The men had almost no food or water and only a few days' worth of battery power in their headlamps. There was a group of 6 miners in one area, a group of 12 in another, and a lone miner who was partially buried at a third location. There was no contact between the groups and no way for them to communicate with the outside world. Within minutes of the bump, off-duty miners and specially trained dragermen were converging on the mine. Dragermen wear gas masks and breathing apparatus invented by a German named Alexander Draeger that allow them to survive the methane and carbon dioxide gas that seep out of coal strata. Another group, barefaced miners, can work harder and faster than the dragermen, but have to be confined to areas that don't have any gas. The rescuers began digging their way through the collapsed passageways, working in spaces so cramped that they were forced to cut the handles off their pickaxes in order to swing them. Even a strong man could last no more than 3 or 4 minutes on a pickaxe in such circumstances, so they worked in 4-man teams and kept rotating positions so that the pick never stopped, as one report put it. After several days, they started digging past the crushed bodies of dead miners. The effect of encountering a putrefying body in the close confines of the passageways was devastating, and almost everyone vomited when they encountered one. Often the dead were known personally to the men who were digging them out. Some rescuers couldn't take the psychological trauma and asked to be taken off the job, and others were able to suppress their reactions and continue digging. There was no dishonor for those who couldn't take it, and tremendous admiration for those who could. The miner's code of rescue meant that each trapped miner had the knowledge that he would never be buried alive if it were humanly possible for his friends to reach him, a 1960 study called Individual and Group Behavior in a Coal Mine Disaster explained. At the same time, the code was not rigid enough to ostracize those who could not face the rescue role. Meanwhile, 2 miles down the mine shaft, 19 men sat in absolute darkness, trying to figure out what to do. One of the groups included a man whose arm had been pinned between 2 timbers and, out of earshot, the others discussed whether to amputate it or not. The man kept begging them to, but they decided against it and he eventually died. Both groups ran out of food and water and started to drink their own urine. Some used coal dust or bark from the timbers to mask the taste. Some were so hungry that they tried to eat chunks of coal as well. There was an unspoken prohibition against crying, though some men allowed themselves to quietly break down after the lamps died, and many of them avoided thinking about their families. Mostly, they just thought about neutral topics like hunting. One man obsessed over the fact that he owed $1.40 for a car part and hoped that his wife would pay it after he died. Almost immediately, certain men stepped into leadership roles. While there was still lamplight, these men scouted open passageways to see if they could escape and tried to dig through rock falls that were blocking their path. When they ran out of water, one man went in search of more and managed to find a precious gallon, which he distributed to the others. These men were also instrumental in getting their fellow survivors to start drinking their own urine or trying to eat coal. Canadian psychologists who interviewed the miners after their rescue determined that these early leaders tended to lack empathy and emotional control, that they were not concerned with the opinions of others, that they associated with only 1 or 2 other men in the group, and that their physical abilities far exceeded their verbal abilities. But all of these traits allowed them to take forceful, life-saving action where many other men might not. Once the escape attempts failed, different kinds of leaders emerged. In what researchers termed the survival period, the ability to wait in complete darkness without giving up hope or succumbing to panic became crucial. Researchers determined that the leaders during this period were entirely focused on group morale and used skills that were diametrically opposed to those of the men who had led the escape attempts. They were highly sensitive to people's moods. They intellectualized things in order to meet group needs. They reassured the men who were starting to give up hope, and they worked hard to be accepted by the entire group. Without exception, men who were leaders during one period were almost completely inactive during the other. No one, it seemed, was suited to both roles. These two kinds of leaders more or less correspond to the male and female roles that emerge spontaneously in open society during catastrophes such as earthquakes or the Blitz. They reflect an ancient duality that is masked by the ease and safety of modern life, but that becomes immediately apparent when disasters strike. If women aren't present to provide the empathic leadership that every group needs, certain men will do it. If men aren't present to take immediate action in an emergency, women will step in. Almost all the female Carnegie Hero Award recipients acted in situations where there were no men present. To some degree, the sexes are interchangeable, meaning they can easily be substituted for one another, but gender roles aren't. Both are necessary for the healthy functioning of society, and those roles will always be filled regardless of whether both sexes are available to do it. The coming together that societies often experience during catastrophes is usually temporary, but sometimes the effect can last years or even decades. British historians have linked the hardships of the Blitz and the social unity that followed to a landslide vote that brought the Labour Party into power in 1945 and eventually gave the United Kingdom national health care and a strong welfare state. The Blitz hit after years of poverty in England, and both experiences served to bind the society together in ways that rejected the primacy of business interests over the welfare of the people. That era didn't end until the wartime generation started to fade out and Margaret Thatcher was elected Prime Minister in 1979. In every upheaval, we rediscover humanity and regain freedoms, one sociologist wrote about England's reaction to the war. We relearn some old truths about the connection between happiness, unselfishness, and the simplification of living. What catastrophes seem to do, sometimes in the span of a few minutes, is turn back the clock on 10,000 years of social evolution. Self-interest gets subsumed into group interest because there is no survival outside group survival, and that creates a social bond that many people sorely miss. 20 years after the end of the Siege of Sarajevo, I returned to find people talking a little sheepishly about how much they longed for those days. More precisely, they longed for who they'd been back then. Even my taxi driver on the ride from the airport told me that during the war, he'd been in a special unit that slipped through the enemy lines to help other besieged enclaves. "And now look at me," he said, dismissing the dashboard with a wave of his hand. For a former soldier to miss the clarity and importance of his wartime duty is one thing, but for civilians it is quite another. "Whatever I say about the war, I still hate it," one survivor, Nidzara Ametasevich, made sure to tell me after I'd interviewed her about the nostalgia of her generation. "I do miss something from the war, but I also believe that the world we are living in and the peace that we have is very fucked up if somebody is missing war, and many people do." Ametasevich is now a prominent Bosnian journalist who has dedicated her life to understanding the war crimes that blossomed all around her when she was young. She was 17 when the war broke out, and within weeks had been hit by shrapnel from an artillery round that crashed into her parents' apartment. She was rushed to the hospital and underwent reconstructive surgery to her severely damaged leg without anesthesia. "They hold you down and you scream," she said when I asked about the pain. "That helps." The hospital was overflowing with wounded. They were laid out in the toilets, in the hallways, in the entranceways, and the staff didn't even have the time to change blood-soaked sheets after people died. They just loaded the next person onto the bed and continued working. The first night, an old woman died next to Ametasevich, and somehow rolled onto her in her final agonies. Amatasevich woke in the morning to find the woman on top of her, the first of many bodies she would see during the war. After 2 weeks, Amatasevich was finally sent back to her parents' apartment on crutches and resumed what passed as normal life during wartime. Her neighborhood had organized 5 apartment buildings, perhaps 60 families, into a huge cooperative that shared food and ovens and shelter. Vegetable gardens were planted around the buildings and everyone ate from the food they produced. Water was gathered individually from roof gutters or from hand pumps in town, but virtually everything else was shared. On her 18th birthday, Amatasevich remembers being given a single egg by one of her neighbors. She couldn't figure out how to share it with her friends, so she decided to use the egg to make pancakes so that everyone could have some. The basement of one of the buildings was deep enough to serve as a bomb shelter, and teenagers from the neighborhood led a kind of communal life down there that was almost entirely separate from the adults above ground. The boys would go off to fight on the front line for 10 days at a stretch, and then return to join the girls, who lived down there full-time. Everyone slept on mattresses on the floor together, and ate their meals together, and fell in and out of love together, and played music and talked about literature, and joked about the war. "The boys were like our brothers," Amatasevich said. "It's not like we girls were waiting for them and crying. No, we had a party. To be honest, it was a kind of liberation. The love that we shared was enormous. They'd come from the front lines, and most of them were musicians, and they would have small concerts for us. We didn't believe in heroes. We were punk rockers. Our biggest hero was David Bowie." 6 months into the siege, Amatasevich's parents managed to get her evacuated to Italy because they weren't sure she was going to survive. She had lost a lot of weight after her surgery and never managed to put it back on. Although she was safe in Italy and finally healing from her wounds, the loneliness she felt was unbearable. She was worried that if the war never stopped, everyone would be killed and she would be left alone in the world. She finally started trying to figure out how to get back into Sarajevo, something that almost no one did. From a bureaucratic standpoint, it was even harder than getting out of the besieged city. But with her mother's help, she finally did it. She flew into the blown-up, sandbagged airport and hitched a ride into town and back to her family. "I missed being that close to people. I missed being loved in that way," she told me. "In Bosnia, as it is now, we don't trust each other anymore. We became really bad people. We didn't learn the lesson of the war, which is how important it is to share everything you have with human beings close to you. The best way to explain it is that the war makes you an animal. We were animals. It's insane, but that's the basic human instinct, to help another human being who is sitting or standing or lying close to you." I asked Amatasevich if people had ultimately been happier during the war. "We were the happiest," Amatasevich said. Then she added, "and we laughed more." In bitter safety, I awake. The first time I realized I had a problem, I was in a subway station in New York City. It was almost a year before the attacks of 9/11, and I'd just come back from 2 months in Afghanistan with Ahmad Shah Massoud, the leader of the Northern Alliance. I had no appreciation for how that experience would affect me psychologically, and so I was completely unprepared for the aftermath. Massoud was fighting a desperate action to open up supply lines across the Amu Darya River before winter set in, and he was blocked by Taliban positions on a prominent ridge overlooking the Tajik border. Hundreds of Taliban troops were dug in with tanks and artillery and protected by a few MiG jets that were based at Talokan. Al-Qaeda's infamous 5-5 Commando Brigade was up there, as well as volunteers from Uzbekistan and Chechnya, and Pakistani commanders who shouted over the radio in Urdu and berated the locals for not fighting hard enough. Massoud's men were outnumbered 3-1 and in short supply of everything from tank rounds to food. At one point, I and the men I was with made our way to a frontline position that had just been taken from the Taliban and arrived in time for the inevitable counterattack. We curled up in the slit trenches and listened to rockets come screaming in and detonate against the packed clay earth. The Northern Alliance had no artillery to speak of, so all we could do was stay down and wait for the Taliban to run out of rockets. We eventually managed to get out of there, though we lost one of our pack horses in the barrage. I felt deranged for days afterward, as if I'd lived through the end of the world. By the time I got home, though, I'd stop thinking about that or any of the other horrific things we'd seen. Casualties from an infantry assault through a minefield, starving civilians, MiG jets circling us, looking for a place to drop their bombs. I mentally buried all of it until one day a few months later, when I went into the subway at rush hour to catch the C train downtown. Suddenly, I found myself backed up against an iron support column, convinced I was going to die. For some reason, everything seemed like a threat. There were too many people on the platform, the trains were moving too fast, the lights were too bright, the world was too loud. I couldn't really explain what was wrong, but I was more scared than I'd ever been in Afghanistan. I stood there with my back to the column until I couldn't take it anymore, and then I sprinted for the exit and walked home. The nation wasn't at war yet, and I had no idea that what I'd just experienced had anything to do with combat. I just thought I was going crazy. For the next several months, I kept having panic attacks whenever I was in a small place with too many people. Airplanes, ski gondolas, bars. The incidents eventually stopped happening, and I didn't think about it again until 2 or 3 years later, when I found myself at a family picnic, talking to a woman who worked as a psychotherapist. The United States had just invaded Iraq, and that may have been what prompted her to ask whether I'd been traumatized by the wars I'd covered. I told her that I didn't think so, but that for a while, I'd had panic attacks in crowded places. She nodded. "That's called post-traumatic stress disorder," she said. "You'll be hearing a lot more about that in the next few years." What I had was classic short-term PTSD. From an evolutionary perspective, it's exactly the response you want to have when your life is in danger. You want to be vigilant, you want to avoid situations where you are not in control, you want to react to strange noises, you want to sleep lightly and wake easily, you want to have flashbacks and nightmares that remind you of specific threats to your life, and you want to be by turns angry and depressed. Anger keeps you ready to fight, and depression keeps you from being too active and putting yourself in more danger. Flashbacks also serve to remind you of the danger that's out there, a highly efficient, single-event, survival learning mechanism, as one researcher termed it. All humans react to trauma in this way, and most mammals do as well. It may be unpleasant, but it's preferable to getting killed. Like depression and grief, PTSD can be exacerbated by other factors, but tends to diminish with time. My panic attacks eased up and eventually stopped, though a strange emotionality took their place. I found myself tearing up at things that I otherwise would have just smiled at or not noticed at all. Once, I got so emotional watching an elderly clerk doing her job at the post office that I had to walk out and come back later to send my mail. It happened in my sleep, too. Strange combat dreams that weren't scary but somehow triggered a catastrophic outpouring of sorrow. Invariably, I would wake up and just lie there in the dark, trying to figure out why feelings that seemed to belong to other people kept spilling out of me. I wasn't a soldier, though I'd spent plenty of time with soldiers, and at that point I hadn't lost any close friends in combat. And yet when I went to sleep, it was like I became part of some larger human experience that was utterly heartbreaking. It was far too much to acknowledge when I was awake. I had a much older friend named Joanna who was very concerned about how I was faring psychologically after the wars I'd covered. Joanna died soon after I came back from one particularly long stint overseas, and I had almost no reaction to the news until I started talking to her nephew about the trips she'd taken during the early 1960s to register black voters in the South. People were getting killed for doing that, and I remember Joanna telling me that she and her husband, Ellis, never knew if she would make it back alive when she left on those trips. After a year of covering combat, there was something about her willingness to die for others, for human dignity, that completely undid me. Stories about soldiers had the same effect on me. Completely divorced from any sense of patriotism, accounts of great bravery could emotionally annihilate me. The human concern for others would seem to be the one story that, adequately told, no person can fully bear to hear. Joanna's husband, Ellis, was part Lakota, part Apache, and had been born on a wagon in Missouri just before the Great Depression. He married Joanna when she was 16 and he was 25. I would go visit them on weekends when I was in college. Joanna would put me to work around their property until it got dark, and then the three of us would have dinner together. Afterward, Ellis and I would retreat to the living room to talk. He would smoke Carlton ultralights and drink cold coffee and tell me about the world, and I mostly just sat there and listened. He seemed to have access to a kind of ancient human knowledge that completely transcended the odd, cloistered life that he was living in Connecticut when I met him. One of his favorite stories took place during some senseless war between the English and the French. At one point, it was proposed that a lighthouse off the coast of France be destroyed by British warships to impede shipping and navigation. "Sir," an English admiral reminded the king, "we are at war with the French, not with the entire human race." If war were purely and absolutely bad in every single aspect, and toxic in all its effects, it would probably not happen as often as it does. But in addition to all the destruction and loss of life, war also inspires ancient human virtues of courage, loyalty, and selflessness that can be utterly intoxicating to the people who experience them. Ellis's story is affecting because it demonstrates war's ability to ennoble people rather than just debase them. The Iroquois Nation presumably understood the transformative power of war when they developed parallel systems of government that protected civilians from warriors and vice versa. Peacetime leaders, called sachems, were often chosen by women and had complete authority over the civil affairs of the tribe until war broke out. At that point, war leaders took over, and their sole concern was the physical survival of the tribe. They were not concerned with justice or harmony or fairness. They were concerned only with defeating the enemy. If the enemy tried to negotiate an end to hostilities, however, it was the sachems, not the war leaders, who made the final decision. If the offer was accepted, the war leaders stepped down so that the sachems could resume leadership of the tribe. The Iroquois system reflected the radically divergent priorities that a society must have during peacetime and during war. Because modern society often fights wars far away from the civilian population, soldiers wind up being the only people who have to switch back and forth. Siegfried Sassoon, who was wounded in World War I, wrote a poem called Sick Leave that perfectly described the crippling alienation many soldiers feel at home. "In bitter safety I awake, unfriended," he wrote, "and while the dawn begins with slashing rain, I think of the battalion in the mud." Given the profound alienation of modern society, when combat vets say that they miss the war, they might be having an entirely healthy response to life back home. Iroquois warriors did not have to struggle with that sort of alienation because warfare and society existed in such close proximity that there was effectively no transition from one to the other. In addition, defeat meant that a catastrophic violence might be visited upon everyone they loved. And in that context, fighting to the death made complete sense from both an evolutionary and an emotional point of view. Certainly, some Iroquois warriors must have been traumatized by the warfare they were engaged in. Much of it was conducted at close quarters with clubs and hatchets. But they didn't have to contain that trauma within themselves. The entire society was undergoing wartime trauma, so it was a collective experience and therefore an easier one. A rapid recovery from psychological trauma must have been exceedingly important in our evolutionary past, and individuals who could climb out of their shock reaction and resume fleeing or fighting must have survived at higher rates than those who couldn't. A 2011 study of street children in Burundi found the lowest PTSD rates among the most aggressive and violent children. Aggression seemed to buffer them from the effects of previous trauma that they had experienced. Because trauma recovery is greatly affected by social factors, and because it presumably had such high survival value in our evolutionary past, one way to evaluate the health of a society might be to look at how quickly its soldiers or warriors recover psychologically from the experience of combat. Almost everyone exposed to trauma reacts by having some sort of short-term reaction to it, acute PTSD. That reaction clearly has evolved in mammals to keep them both reactive to danger and out of harm's way until the threat has passed. Long-term PTSD, on the other hand, the kind that can last years or even a lifetime, is clearly maladaptive and relatively uncommon. Many studies have shown that in the general population, at most 20% of people who have been traumatized get long-term PTSD. Rather than being better prepared for extraordinary danger, these people become poorly adjusted to everyday life. Rape is one of the most psychologically devastating things that can happen to a person, for example, far more traumatizing than most military deployments. And according to a 1992 study, close to 100% of rape survivors exhibited extreme trauma immediately afterward. And yet almost half of rape survivors experienced a significant decline in their trauma symptoms within weeks or months of their assault. That is a far faster recovery rate than soldiers have exhibited in the recent wars America has fought. One of the reasons, paradoxically, is because the trauma of combat is interwoven with other positive experiences that become difficult to separate from the harm. Treating combat veterans is different from treating rape victims because rape victims don't have this idea that some aspects of their experience are worth retaining, I was told by Dr. Rachel Yehuda, the director of traumatic stress studies at Mount Sinai Hospital in New York. Yehuda has studied PTSD in a wide range of people, including combat veterans and Holocaust survivors. For most people in combat, their experiences range from the best of times to the worst of times. It's the most important thing someone has ever done, especially since these people are so young when they go in. And it's probably the first time they've ever been free, completely, of societal constraints. They're going to miss being entrenched in this defining world. Except for sociopaths, one of the most traumatic events that a soldier can experience is witnessing harm to others, even to the enemy. In a survey carried out after the first Gulf War by David Marlowe, an anthropologist who later worked for the U.S. Department of Defense, combat veterans reported that killing an enemy soldier, or even witnessing one getting killed, was more distressing than being wounded themselves. But the very worst experience, by far, was having a friend die. In war after war, army after army, losing a buddy is considered the most devastating thing that can possibly happen. It is far more disturbing than experiencing mortal danger oneself, and often serves as a trigger for psychological breakdown on the battlefield or later in life. Still, most soldiers go through that and other terrible experiences and don't wind up with long-term trauma. Multiple studies, including a 2007 analysis from the Institute of Medicine and the National Research Council, found that a person's chance of getting chronic PTSD is in great part a function of their experiences before going to war. Statistically, the 20% of people who fail to overcome trauma tend to be those who are already burdened by psychological issues, either because they inherited them or because they suffered abuse as children. If you fought in Vietnam and your twin brother did not, but he suffers from a psychiatric disorder such as schizophrenia, you are statistically more likely to get PTSD. If you experienced the death of a loved one, or if you weren't held enough as a child, you are up to 7 times more likely to develop the kinds of anxiety disorders that contribute to PTSD. According to a 2000 study in the Journal of Consulting and Clinical Psychology, if you have an educational deficit, if you are female, if you have a low IQ, or if you were abused as a child, you are also at an elevated risk of developing PTSD. The elevated risk for women is due to their greater likelihood of getting PTSD after a physical assault. For other forms of trauma, men and women are fairly equal. These risk factors are nearly as predictive of PTSD as the severity of the trauma itself. Suicide is often seen as an extreme expression of PTSD, but researchers have not yet found any relationship between suicide and combat. Combat veterans are statistically no more likely to kill themselves than veterans who were never under fire. The much-discussed estimate of 22 vets a day committing suicide in the United States is deceptive. It was only in 2008 that, for the first time in decades, the suicide rate among veterans surpassed the civilian rate in America. And though each death is enormously tragic, the majority of those veterans were over the age of 50. Many were Vietnam vets, and, generally speaking, the more time that passes after a trauma, the less likely a suicide is to have anything to do with it. Among younger vets, deployment to Iraq or Afghanistan actually lowers the risk of suicide because soldiers with obvious mental health issues are not deployed with their units. Further confusing the issue, voluntary service has resulted in a military population that has a disproportionate number of young people with a history of sexual abuse. One theory for this holds that military service is an easy way for young people to get out of their home, and so the military will disproportionately draw recruits from troubled families. According to a 2014 study in the American Medical Association's JAMA Psychiatry, men with military service are now twice as likely to report sexual assault during their childhood as men who never served. This was not true during the draft. Sexual abuse is a well-known predictor of depression and other mental health issues, and the military suicide rate may in part be a result of that. Killing seems to traumatize people regardless of the danger they're in or the perceived righteousness of their cause. Pilots of unmanned drones who watch their missiles kill human beings by remote camera have been calculated to have the same PTSD rates as pilots who fly actual combat missions in war zones. And even among regular infantry, danger and trauma are not necessarily connected. During the 1973 Yom Kippur War, when Israel was simultaneously invaded by Egypt and Syria, rear-based troops had psychological breakdowns at three times the rate of elite frontline troops relative to the casualties they suffered. In other words, rear-based troops had fairly light casualties but suffered a disproportionately high level of psychiatric breakdowns. Similarly, more than 80% of psychiatric casualties in the U.S. Army's 7th Corps came from support units that took almost no incoming fire during the air campaign of the first Gulf War. The discrepancy might be due to the fact that intensive training and danger create what is known as unit cohesion, strong emotional bonds within the company or the platoon, and high unit cohesion is correlated with lower rates of psychiatric breakdown. During World War II, American airborne units had some of the lowest psychiatric casualty rates of the entire U.S. military relative to their number of wounded. The same is true for armies in other countries. Sri Lankan special forces experience far more combat than line troops, and yet in 2010 they were found to suffer from significantly lower rates of both physical and mental health issues. The one mental health issue they led everyone else in was hazardous drinking. And Israeli commanders suffered four times the mortality rate of their men during the Yom Kippur War, yet had one-fifth the rate of psychological breakdown on the battlefield. All this is a new way to think about battlefield trauma, however. For most of America's history, psychological breakdown on the battlefield, as well as impairment afterward, has been written off to neurosis, shell shock, or simple cowardice. When men have failed to obey orders due to trauma, they have been beaten, imprisoned, treated with electrocution, or simply shot as a warning to others. It was not until after the Vietnam War that the American Psychiatric Association, APA, listed combat trauma as an official diagnosis. Tens of thousands of vets were struggling with post-Vietnam syndrome, nightmares, insomnia, addiction, paranoia, and their struggle could no longer be written off to weakness or personal failings. Obviously, these problems could also affect war reporters, cops, firemen, or anyone else subjected to trauma. In 1980, the APA finally included post-traumatic stress disorder in the third edition of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. 35 years after finally acknowledging the problem, the U.S. military now has the highest reported PTSD rate in its history and probably in the world. American soldiers appear to suffer PTSD at around twice the rate of British soldiers who were in combat with them. The United States currently spends more than $4 billion annually in disability compensation for PTSD, most of which will continue for the entire lifetime of these veterans. Horrific experiences are unfortunately a human universal, but long-term impairment from them is not. And despite billions of dollars spent on treatment, roughly half of Iraq and Afghanistan veterans have applied for permanent PTSD disability. Since only 10% of our armed forces experience actual combat, the majority of vets claiming to suffer from PTSD seem to have been affected by something other than direct exposure to danger. This is not a new phenomenon. Decade after decade and war after war, American combat deaths have generally dropped, while disability claims have risen. Most disability claims are for medical issues and should decline with casualty rates and combat intensity, but they don't. They are in an almost inverse relationship with one another. Soldiers in Vietnam suffered one-quarter the mortality rate of soldiers in World War II, for example, but filed for both physical and psychological disability compensation at a rate that was 50% higher. It's tempting to attribute that to the toxic reception they had at home, but that doesn't seem to be the case. Today's vets claim three times the number of disabilities that Vietnam